What's up? Welcome in. I'm Jonathan Von Tobel, your host for today here on The Edge. We're going to begin every single day just like this. Three biggest stories of the weekend here on this Monday. First of which, story breaks last night. Jeff Passan had the report. Jeff Passan, by the way, who has a dynamite Elmo impression. Major League Baseball Players Association has decided to bring back their own proposal to Major League Baseball for what they feel like should be a return to action. So some of the format here, season would be 114 games, would run from June 30th to October 31st. Now, it's obviously a clear difference, right, from the 82-game season proposed by the owners. Disconnected is the amount of games, as we know about, right? More games played, at least as what they expect and what's been reported by Passan, the more money owners are expected to lose. We know about all the other issues in Major League Baseball, right? They want the players' deferred salaries in the event of a canceled postseason. Players would have the option to opt out of a potential 2020 season. This is interesting for multiple reasons, right? We've talked about it not only on a numbers game, but here on The Edge, and we've talked about it multiple shows. I've brought this up. You know, as we sit here and we don't have a specific amount of games that we're going to play, win percentages are available at multiple books like DraftKings for Major League Baseball. Can't really bet on those unless you know what exactly is going to be from a season standpoint, how many games they're going to play. Now we at least have a range, 82 to 114 games. So it makes at least the handicap for win percentages a little bit more easier for you if out there if you want to actually handicap those. But again, Major League Baseball Players Association coming back with this should note that Passan reported owners are expected to actually decline this outright, don't want any part of this whatsoever. A lot of it has to do with the amount of games played, but it is interesting to see what they would at least be willing to do, the players. On top of that, there's a couple of other things that have been added to the proposal by the players. Expanded playoffs for 2 years from 10 teams to 14, and additional commitments to players wearing microphones. That's been a pretty big push as we've seen more sporting events that are more intimate during this quarantine over the last 2 months. And the one that I find more interesting, offering to hold events such as offseason all-star game or a home run derby in the offseason, giving us a little bit more baseball to bet on once baseball is indeed over. So you'd have a couple more events if this is indeed agreed upon. But as noted, Passan expects this to be shot down immediately by a lot of the owners. The second story, it's not only fight week this week, but it is NBA week here on The Edge because we are waiting for Thursday. The league is planning to vote on Thursday with the Board of Governors to decide a format when it returns to play. Four options to vote on for the association has been reported by multiple spots. First, directly to the postseason with 16 teams, format as we expect and we know in the NBA. Problem with that is no tune-up games. How do you get these guys ready to go if you're just going to go straight into the postseason? Exhibition games, regular season games, whatever have you. Second, World Cup style, 20 teams, group play before entering the bracket. That was a really popular one, actually, during the week when we talked about this and when you saw some of the reports, the fact that they would have the group play stage, only 20 teams would be available, 14 teams from the Western Conference, just, I believe, six teams coming from the Eastern Conference competing there. Your third option was the one with the most momentum behind it from a lot of these owners, and that would be eight regular season games to decide seeding in a play-in tournament for the final season East Conference. That would include 22 teams for the association to get in, and again, eight regular season games to decide seeding. And the fourth and final option, again, all of these up for vote this Thursday by the NBA and the Board of Governors, all 30 teams return in an attempt to reach 72 regular season games with a play-in tournament. So those are the four options the NBA is expected to vote on this coming Thursday for the Board of Governors. Again, according to multiple reports, the one that has the most traction behind it is the third option. Eight regular season games, 22 teams to decide seeding in a play-in tournament in the final seeds of each conference. But this is going to be massive for Thursday. And I've been a proponent of, look, the NBA, they've been talking with their players. They've been talking with Orlando. They've been figuring this out behind the scenes. When the NBA returns, they're going to be ready to go with all three facets of the salary, location, and format. Thursday is a big way or a big step toward that. And then finally, UFC on ESPN 9. It was a really good card. Tyron Woodley looked really disinterested in the loss in the main event. But I think really the biggest format change was the size of the octagon and the fact that this octagon was much smaller. Lou Finocchiaro, Gamblou brought this up multiple times throughout the week, as did multiple handicappers. Matt Holt was big on this as well, that maybe a smaller octagon would lead to a little bit more action and a few more finishes. And sure enough, over at the Apex here in Las Vegas, first four fights ended in finishes. Six of the fights in total, both prelim and main event, ended in finishes overall. So do we see that again this upcoming weekend for UFC 250 is going to be the massive question, because smaller octagon octagon could lead to some action. And guess what? You have a lot of bantamweights on the card who like to throw some fists. So we'll see if that is going to be the case. Let's do it.
This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
Yeah, the familiar horns. We're back here on VSiN. The Edge is back 10 a.m. Pacific time, Monday through Friday from now on here on the Sports Betting Network. I'm your host, Jonathan Von Tobel. Just 1 hour, but we're really excited and we're revamping the show. I cannot wait to get into this. You know, I've been chomping at the bit. Lucky enough to still be working, of course, throughout the last 2 months. We know what we've been going on here. I'm filling in here and there, but we have a lot of good stuff in store for you here on The Edge. A revamping of the show of sorts, a lot of new segments and a lot of learning. And I think really the whole point I want to do with this show for the most part is, you know, walking through at least what I like to do as a handicapper and learning and making mistakes and growing from that. And we're going to do a lot of it. We have a lot of new benchmarks to introduce, a couple today, nothing but analytics as we take a look at the NBA postseason by a team by team comparison. We're going to look at weaknesses for each team, strengths for each team, and which teams are bad matchups and why. We'll start with the Los Angeles Lakers later today. And this was pretty popular last year during baseball season, so we're going to tweak it a little bit as we look at a season long aspect of it. But later today, because the Horns we're so familiar, we're going to bring back buy low, sell high for Major League Baseball. We got three pitchers today, all on the sell high list that we can look forward to at the beginning of the season. Some of their numbers and their metrics. Maybe lean a little bit towards either some inflated prices or some guys that you can go up against, and we'll have that later in the show. And then in just a couple of minutes, Megan Olivi is going to join us as we talk about UFC 250. If you have watched The Edge, if you have watched VSiN in general, you know that myself and a couple of us here on The Edge are actually big fight fans. So this week we are building up again to fight week, UFC 250. Nunez Spencer, of course, the main event. We'll see if Nunez can pull it off as a nearly $6 favorite. I'd say that she probably will. Olivia's going to help us with that in just a couple of minutes. But we were going over some of the big stories at the top of the show, namely, right, the MLBPA and their proposal, the fact that the NBA is going to vote on Thursday with their board of governors, and the fact that UFC on ESPN, it was a free card, so you could watch it on ESPN, over the weekend at the Apex was a really exciting card, mainly because of all the finishes and what's going to happen when you have to continuously have some of these cards in some of these smaller venues like this, if it's going to happen over at the Apex, and how much is the correlation between a smaller ring and some of the finishes that we saw. And again, the first four fights on the card, right, prelim included, of course, first four fights all saw finishes, six overall fights on the card, both main and prelim saw finishes as well. Does that correlate and does that kind of carry over to a card this weekend that is just full of bantamweight fighters that have a lot to fight for, and it's just going to be a really good matchup overall on the main card, which we're going to break down with Megan Olivi here coming up in just a few minutes. But today is going to be great. Again, I want to welcome everybody in because The Edge, I think we're going to try to do things a little bit differently as we move forward here. We're just with you and hour, but we're going to experiment a lot too, and we're going to have a lot of fun because we're going to try to get a little bit more visual, but we're going to have a lot of numbers and a lot of analytics, and the whole point is to help build you up as a handicapper, put you up, get a lot of tools in the box for you to use as you move forward and try to get better, as I try to get better too. And I think that's the whole process about it, is using everything possible to go ahead and improve as a handicapper. So let's head out to the phone line. Megan Olivi is nice enough to give us a couple minutes. She covers the UFC mixed martial arts. You can find her on ESPN, at Megan Olivi up on Twitter. Megan, appreciate some time today. So we opened up, we were talking about this a little bit. So the card over the weekend at the Apex, right? The smaller octagon, first four fights, all finishes, six overall in the card were finishes. How much did the two things correlate in your mind when you were watching that transpire, and what do you think is going to carry over with this weekend just when it comes to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously the smaller octagon, there's less room for you to run and kind of work the space. So smaller octagon usually is indicative of a higher finish rate. When we had the organization, the WEC, they also had that smaller octagon, and they had a really high finish rate. I think it just makes athletes fight a little bit differently, and it keeps them closer together. So, yeah, we saw that over the weekend, some really, really great fights. I wouldn't say that it necessarily changes the course of fights, though, because, you know, our athletes train for everything in all sorts of different situations. A lot of gyms don't even have an octagon, so they're training on, you know, open mat space or whatever it may be. But it is always fun to kind of watch and see what will happen in those situations. For this coming weekend, you know, I just think overall it's going to be interesting to have a pay-per-view card inside of our Apex, which is, you know, a a quite small facility. You know, when we were in Jacksonville, that was a massive arena that was, you know, completely empty except for our tiny crew and Octagon on the floor. But for this one, I think it'll be interesting just to see, you know, how we do our pay-per-views and production-wise, to keep how it's going to look the same, but be in this really small atmosphere in this small building. So I think UFC 250 is going to be a fun one to watch play out.
So, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, like the venue itself, because we saw a lot, right, 249 in the cards following. The intimacy of the venue also led to fighters being able to hear analysis. Have you heard much of that? Has that been a topic of conversation moving forward? Has that been a big factor still?
Yeah. It's so awkward. Like, even for me, when I'm doing reports or when I was backstage in Jacksonville doing interviews, sometimes I would get a winner as a fight was going on, and I almost felt like I had to control the volume of my voice because it carried through the building. And when I would go out there and do commentary for some of the walkouts, it's shocking. It is shocking how loud, because we are doing a live broadcast and we also wear headsets. So it's not like we, you know, are aware of what things sound like. You kind of have to take that full headset off and really see, like, oh crap, we're really loud. So it's strange. I mean, you can hear the fighters breathing. They can hear what we're saying. A bunch of fighters, you know, have said, like, it's so weird that it's quiet, or I prefer the quiet. And I could hear that commentary in Jacksonville. It will not be the same, I don't think, in the Apex. I know I'll have my own room backstage where they won't be able to hear me or anything like that. But it's just a really odd time right now for our athletes. And I think it's something that if they compete in any of these next few months, that they'll never forget the rest of their lives.
Yep. All right, let's get to the card itself. Main event, Felicia Spencer, Amanda Nunes. Nunes in the range of a $6 favorite, a very big favorite, rightfully so. So the question here for you is, what does Spencer have to do to pull this upset? What's the matchup like for her?
You know, this is an interesting one. Felicia only has one loss in her record. We know a lot about her and her submission skills, but in her last outing, she had a first-round knockout, a really, really beautiful performance at the end of February. And what something big that we learned about Felicia is not just that she's a talented mixed martial artist, but even in that one loss to Chris Cyborg, her tenacity and her ability to never give up and her toughness, and she always stayed in that fight. And listen, that's a fight for a lot of females when they have faced Chris Cyborg that has ended early for them, but not for Felicia Spencer. So I think, you know, that's so incredibly important to know that you can be the hammer and you can be the nail in a matchup and never give up. And it's not like when things are going bad, okay, I'm just going to kind of like let the tide take me out. So I think this could be a really interesting one. I would love to see some grappling in this one. I think we all know Amanda and the power in her hands and her kicks. But I would just really love to see how this plays out if it gets to go to the canvas.
Is Amanda's gas tank still an issue, do you think, for her?
I don't think so at all. I honestly think that that's been a long time overcome. I know that she actually has some sinus issues.
Yeah.
So she's figured out, you know, what works best for her, how to come out to Las Vegas. She needs to adjust, like, for, you know, more than just your average, like, Tuesday arrival date for a Saturday fight. So I think she takes all the right steps to be the best in the world in every situation. And I really think that she's always prepared for a hard 25-minute fight.
So I'm curious, you know, let's just say, like, again, she's a $6 favorite, implied probability that she's going to win this fight many more times than she's not. What's next for Nunes if she does win this fight? Like, I'm waiting for Shevchenko Nunes again, because that was two fights that I really enjoyed. But what's next for her? Because she's by far head and shoulders above her weight class at this point.
Yeah, I mean, she's a double champion.
Right.
You know, I don't know. And it's crazy. And I think that we see this a lot of times when there is a dominant champion. Like, oftentimes when John Jones wins, we say, well, what could be next for him? You know, I think there is always something, and the UFC always does come up with matchups that make sense and that people want to see. But it's hard. Amanda is just so incredible. But I don't disagree with you. Even though she defeated Valentina Shevchenko twice, I almost feel like we didn't understand, like, how great that was, because we didn't understand how great Valentina was until she went into a weight class where that better suits her.
So I don't know.
I think there's a lot to look forward to, and I think that the women's bantamweight division and featherweight division are continuing to grow and really add an arsenal of athletes that are just talented and keep getting sharper. So I think there's a lot to look forward to, but certainly that is an interesting question. I guess we'll see after however Saturday night plays out.
Let's dive into the rest of this card then. So we mentioned at the top, three bantamweight bouts on the main card. Cody Garbrandt is going to attempt to stop the three-fight skid here. All three of the finishes, last two were in the first round. What happened to Cody? Because his last win, we saw him, he was absolutely dominant against Dominic Cruz. That was a long time ago. But these last three fights, he's not been the same guy.
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily what happened to Cody, but I think it's just a testament to that everybody in the top 15 of that bantamweight division is a killer.
Yeah.
And any one of them could be any other one of them on any given night. I mean, it's really, for me, bantamweight is one of the most exciting divisions in our entire organization because they are so talented. I mean, a big reason we like these smaller weight classes, flyweight, bantamweight, featherweight, is because they're so technical and fast. Well, bantamweight also has so many strikers with power and so many submission specialists that I just think I wouldn't necessarily say Cody's not good or anything like that. I would say he's facing the best of the best, and sometimes this is just what happens. I think that Cody has even said himself, once he gets rocked, he kind of goes on autopilot, which is to be, swinging for the fences, and sometimes the knockout works in your favor, and sometimes it doesn't. And I think that's what we've really seen from him lately. I like this matchup with Rafael Simsel quite a bit. Rafael has been at the top of the bantamweight division since the WEC, for 10 years. He's an incredible jiu-jitsu practitioner, a great striker, and he's a guy that's always kind of, I don't want to say counted out, but we don't give him enough credit a lot of times in the matchups. And he is so talented that he could make a huge statement here if he defeats the former champion.
So when you talk about Asuncao, he's only got four wins via knockout. What is Cody's ground game like? Like, if it gets down there, what do you give his chances here?
Cody's a really talented grappler. Yeah. Cody was an Ohio State wrestling champion in high school. Very talented grappler. Trains with one of the best grappling teams in the world, the Team Alpha Male. Has some really great grappling coaches. I would say Rafael probably has the Brazilian jiu-jitsu, overall edge, but I just think in terms of grappling, this could be a super, super fun one.
So let's talk about two of the hottest bantamweights on the card, Aljamain Sterling, Corey Sanhagen, fight on the main card. Sterling's laying $1.20. Who's got the matchup edge here, if any? Because the price says, obviously, it's going to be a very tight fight.
I think it's going to be a very tight fight. I think whoever made those odds is spot on, because I love this matchup so much. And I also hate this matchup because Aljamain and Corey are two of the kindest people on our roster. They are two of the most talented individuals. They're just good people. And, somebody's course of their life is going to be changed when they get their hand raised on Saturday night. And sometimes that's challenging to watch fights like that because, you just want the best for both of them. But I love this matchup because it's one of those things where these guys deserve this fight. This is going to be pretty evenly matched up, and it's going to be so, so fun to watch. I really don't think that there's a way that this is not like an incredibly exciting fight, whether it lasts 1 minute or all 15.
Thank you to leave it with us. So I have a couple of friends who cover mixed martial arts, and the one name recently that has always been brought up, like, you got to watch this guy, is Sean O'Malley, undefeated in his MMA career. So he's a $5 favorite, nearly a $5 favorite this weekend. Is that warranted in your mind?
Yeah, I think for me, odds are always difficult because the reason we watch fights is because anything can happen, and every athlete that goes in there has the chance to win on any given night. I mean, you're never going to, have these crazy mismatches where you're like, oh, they didn't belong in there. So for me, it's a little challenging. I do think Sean O'Malley can be a champion in the future. I think Sean O'Malley has the makings of one of the future champions. He's a talented mixed martial artist. He is a dedicated fighter. And he is just really creative inside the octagon. I love watching Sean fight, and I know how hard he works. So I do think that this is a big matchup for him. Again, it's a big platform for him to make a statement and continue to grow and say, like, there is a reason I have this hype behind me. And it is because I am as good as everyone is saying.
Yeah. Hey, so before we get you out of here, any other fights either on the main card that we didn't mention or maybe some prelim fights that you're excited for that, you know, listeners, viewers should have their eye on?
Well, you know what? For me, we talk a lot about the bantamweights that are on this card, but we're ignoring a big man in Cody Stamann. Yeah. Cody Stamann is also fighting, and he is ranked, I believe, like number 12 in the division. Actually, Sean O'Malley isn't even ranked in the division yet. So I think we need to keep an eye on Cody Stamann. He's fighting Brian Kelleher. That's also a huge matchup in the bantamweight division. So I think it's really fun. It's almost a pseudo-tournament of sorts. And I think that this one, that's a really fun one. There's also a great, I mean, great flyweight matchup between Alex Perez and Jussie Formiga. That's a huge one at 125 pounds. Two of the very, very best in not just the flyweight division, but 155 and under. Incredibly talented mixed martial artists. That one very early on in the night, but I would say definitely one to make sure that you catch.
Megan, we appreciate some time today. Thank you very much. We've always enjoyed your work as well.
Thank you so much. I'll see you guys soon.
Yeah, you got it. Megan Olivia again. You can find her work up on ESPN during the fights. It does a lot of stuff for UFC as well. We didn't have enough time. We'll talk about John Jones. I know the guys on Follow the Money earlier today were fired up about John Jones. We know about negotiations in public, especially when it comes with Dana White and some of his finders. When we come back, though, we're not done with mixed martial arts in the UFC by a long shot. We're going to take a look in our prop shop at a fight, an entertaining one, that it was maybe set at late last week. Nothing really official, but two fighters have agreed to a bout. And it's one really old guy versus a dude we haven't seen in a minute. So we'll see what the odds are on that. And I have a feeling that the odds we have seen pop up globally are incorrect. But we'll have that next when it comes to Prop Shop here on The Edge. We're back on VSiN. Father's Day just around the corner. You probably need a gift for a hairy dad. Make your dad proud this year. Get him you and yourself the Manscaped Perfect Package. Perfect Package 3.0 kit with the Essential Lawnmower 3.0, water-resistant cordless body trimmer, and a ton of other liquid formulations to round out your manscaping routine. Inside the Perfect Package, you'll also find Manscaped Crop Preserver and Anti-Chafing Ball Deodorant and Moisturizer, the Crop Reviver Refreshing Spray, and Reduced Chafing Athletic Boxer Briefs. Subscribe to the Perfect Package and get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower trimmer delivered to your door every 3 months. For a limited time, subscribers get a free gift, the Shed Travel Bag, a $39 value. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code VSIN at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code VSIN. It's dad bod season. Time to get smooth. All right, prop shop time here on The Edge. Jonathan Von Tobel, by the way. All right, so over the weekend, Anderson Silva calls for a bout with Conor McGregor. McGregor accepts on Twitter, nothing official. But we do have, of course, now some global odds on something like this happening. We'll talk about the odds of it actually happening in a second. But I wanted to actually focus on the matchup here itself. So Anderson Silva over at One Global Book opened up as a $1.25 favorite over Conor McGregor as part of our prop shop here today. So here's my thing. Immediately, that doesn't make sense to me. McGregor probably should be favored. Silva, of course, we know he's taller, 6'2 versus the 5'9, 3-inch reach advantage. But look at what we've seen from Silva recently, right? One win in his last eight bouts. His last win outside of that victory was over Derek Brunson back in Stephen Bonner at UFC 153 in 2012, which is I don't know if you know, long time. Silva's pretty old, man. Like, I think that's part of this big deal here is the guy has not been the same, Anderson Silva, that we've known, of course, at the brunt of his MMA career. We haven't seen Conor for a while, and I realize that Conor's a pretty public side when it comes to most things. I don't think that this is opening. Let's say this actually happens. Conor McGregor is not opening up as an underdog to Anderson Silva. It'll probably be about $1.20 in favor of Conor. I texted a couple people who cover mixed martial arts, Adam Hill of the Las Vegas Review Journal being one of them. He's been on this show multiple times, been on the network quite a bit. They had the reverse price, Conor -120 in a matchup like this. Now, look, it's only one global book. We also have a prop, actually. Is this fight going to happen in 2020? The yes is 3-1. The no is -400. It's probably not going to happen this year. I mean, think about it from a perspective of the potential fights that you can have with Conor McGregor. Now, the one wrench in the plan, I think, is are they going to fight in front of people, right? Like, Conor, I think the draw for him, you're going to get a lot of pay-per-view buys, but it's the gate, and it's getting all these, you know, the Irish contingent to come in and support him and buy tickets to the event. And if you can't have people at the fight, is it worth putting Conor up for something, especially when it's a fight like Jorge Masvidal, if it's Habib or the winner of Habib Gaethje, I should say. Is it the Nate Diaz trilogy? A fight like with Anderson Silva could potentially like fill a gap, because I know Conor reports are that he wants to take part of Fight Island. But do you want to risk Conor? Again, he'd be a $1.20-$1.25 favorite. Do you want to risk Conor in an event with Anderson Silva for some pay-per-view buys in front of a crowdless arena? Or do you want to save him for a potential fight December, maybe early next year, where you could actually maybe have some sort of a gate and get a little bit more in there? So I don't think this fight is really going to happen. I am not surprised that the no is -400, but more so, I was actually just really intrigued by the price. Because actually, I've talked about this before, it was off the air, but, you know, like John Jones, for example, you know, his whole disconnect with Dana White, he wants to fight Francis Ngannou, and there's this thing that he's asking for a lot of money. Reports are they didn't even give him a figure, but regardless, the first prices that popped up on Jones and Ngannou was like Ngannou -150. I talked to a lot of people who actually think that Jones not only should be the favorite, I talked to one guy who thought Jones should be -300. That was Steve Cofield, who's been on with us here on The Edge multiple times, who used to cover mixed martial arts for Yahoo back in the day, and still does partially. So that's also something, too. I'm really intrigued when you see these first prices pop up, especially for potential fights that are really down the road, because the first prices you see are not necessarily accurate for the most part. And to see something like this, like a Conor McGregor at -105, that was the split over at this global book that I'm talking about, or to see John Jones as an underdog against a Francis Ngannou, I would expect both of those, let's say they open like that, to flip the other way, because both fighters are a little bit more skilled than they're getting credit for in this, and especially the Francis Ngannou and John Jones fight, because if Ngannou is not really a skilled fighter for the most part. He's got a lot of power, and we saw it the last time we saw him in Jacksonville. But John Jones is a really skilled fighter, and he can pick a guy like Francis Ngannou apart when it comes to just skill standing up. It's a tough transition to get up to heavyweight, but that is not a price that I would think is accurate. Same with this, as we're talking about in prop shop here. Conor, I don't think, is opening up as an underdog to Anderson Silva. I'm really certain he'd probably be the $1.20 favorite on the other side. Ooh, piano, I like it. All right, when we come back, we are returning. Buy low, sell high is one of my favorite things from baseball season last year. We're going to get back into it. We'll take a look at it going into baseball season. Three pitchers who are maybe going to be a little inflated price-wise, and maybe one guy you can really play against at the beginning of the season.
And we're back with The Edge.
Gotta ask yourself, what does Dad really want for Father's Day? Steak, of course. For a limited time, you can find a variety of packages filled with beautiful Omaha steaks, plus other premium meat side dishes and desserts, all ideal for Dad's special day. These packages come flash frozen, vacuum sealed, and delivered in a cooler with dry ice safely to his door. All backed by Omaha Steaks' unconditional 100% money-back guarantee. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter the code VSIN into the search bar. Many packages include free shipping and a free one-pound package of their cured, thick, applewood smoked steak-cut bacon. Visit OmahaSteaks.com, enter code VSIN, that's V-S-I-N, in the search bar to shop for Father's Day today. All right, we're back here on The Edge. I'm Jonathan Von Tobel, and this is Buy Low, Sell High. Now, if you listen to the show a lot the last few, I think we started doing it last year, during baseball season, before we got into football season, we switched the time slot. Buy low, sell high. And the whole premise is just like it sounds. It's mainly focused on handicapping pitchers. And really, the mistake that I made at the beginning of this process last year, and again, if you're with us, you probably know this, it was handicapping these pitchers. And we actually had a pretty successful rate, but it was not betting them first five. So what I'm going to do coming into this baseball season, whenever and if it starts, is using these buy low, sell high opportunities. But I'm using them strictly for the first five inning plays because we're really handicapping strictly a lot of these pitchers and these starting pitchers. So I've got the idea here for buy low, sell high now is to take pitchers from every single team and see if they fit in the category of buy low or sell high going into the season. And again, this might not work out for months, but the first two, three, four starts maybe of these pitchers, you could either buy low, sell high because the prices could be a little bit more either inflated or not high enough for guys that have either pitched well above their mean or below their mean when you look at some of their metrics. So three guys today, and I have my personal parameters on things and I'll explain to them as we go along. But the first guy on the list today, we're going in alphabetical order with a lot of these teams, Arizona's Zach Gallen. He is going to be a sell high pitcher here on buy low, sell high. So the issue here, I'll throw out right off the bat with a guy like Gallen, sample size is a little small. He only pitched 80 innings last year. But when you're watching, you see this graphic here for Gallen. You see the delta. That is the difference between his ERA and his xFIP. And those are the two metrics that I like to use and where I like to start. So a minus 1.34, his ERA is actually 1.34 lower than his expected fielding independent. ERA last year over 80 innings was 281. His xFIP over that same stretch, of course, was 415. So when you get that, it's not automatically, okay, we see those differences. What are we going to do after that? You have to dig a little bit into the numbers and see why they are the way they are and if it's worth playing against. Gallen fits the profile for me, not only because of his delta. You look at the walk rate. Walks per nine innings are really poor. Anything over four in walks per nine and 9% in walk rate is considered awful by Fangraphs metrics, right? He's a phenomenal strikeout pitcher, though, and you have to take that into consideration because if you have a high walk rate, at least you can balance that out with a high K rate or high strikeout rate. Gallen does that, but he walks a lot of pitchers on top of that. So the walks aren't really great. Balancing that out with the strikeouts is relatively good. But then you dive into a couple of numbers with Gallen and you realize the hard contact he allows is awful. Hard hit rate last year over these 80 innings pitched was 39.9%. So I have a couple of the metrics that back this up that Gallen statistically has a couple of things in his profile that I want to play against here. Again, the delta is the biggest difference. Then we get a little bit into the narrative with Gallen. Remember, he was considered a steal for Arizona. He's a good young pitcher when he came over. He did a great job in 80 innings pitched. He finished with a 281 ERA. He was 5-3 with a 289 for Arizona when he came over as well. And it's also worth noting, so Fangraphs has these five different projections for players, right? So it projects what their stats could be. It's not the end-all be-all. It is not something that you want to swear on. But he stuck out to me in terms of sell high and what he could be next year. And it's worth noting that five different projections for him on the season for Fangraphs, two of them projected ERAs over 4.19. One of them projected an ERA of 3.9. So again, kind of buying into this thing that the difference that you saw between his ERA and his xFIP is actually something to keep an eye on. And Gallen could have some inflated prices at the beginning of the season, could be a guy to go against. Second guy on the list is going to be Sean Newcomb. Again, another sell high candidate. Big issue here with Newcomb is the fact that his innings, one, were really short. He only pitched 68 and a third last year. Two, a lot of that came out of the bullpen. So a lot of really short stints, sample sizes, don't know what to do. The reason why I include Newcomb here is because by reports, we were coming out of spring training, he was going to be a back end of the rotation guy. So if he is, he's going to make it on this list. ERA is 3.16. xFIP is 4.61. It's a difference of 1.45. So then we get into the issues again with him. Walk rate, similar to Gallen's, right? It's a little high at 382. And the swinging strikes and the strikeouts in general aren't that high. 8.5 batters every nine innings, above average, but doesn't balance out as well as a guy like Gallen who's striking out well over 10 guys per nine innings, but still walking them at a high rate. So you're not striking out as many guys as you probably should with the rate at which you walk them. On top of that, the hard hit rate, 35.7, below average, not something you want if you're going to span this out over a long season. Here's the thing with Newcomb. If he comes out of the pen, I'm not sure how much. Again, this is kind of an experiment. Like I said at the top of the show, with things like this, we're experimenting with it. And if he's a bullpen guy, you can't really use something like sell high against him when these metrics, I'm projecting them out for a whole entire season. But if he is going to be a start of the rotation, it's worth looking at maybe in certain matchups playing against a guy like Sean Newcomb because some of his numbers did dictate that he is not going to be a pitcher that is really worth backing with an xFIP last year out of the bullpen of 461. And then we get to our last guy. And this is the guy that I have the most confidence in out of the three that we have today in terms of our sell high list. And that would be John Means for Baltimore. Pitched 155 innings last year. He had a massive difference between his ERA and his xFIP. 360. The xFIP was well over 5. It's a 188 difference between the two. So you look at Means, he has the largest sample size in terms of innings. He's got the biggest difference as well. And the projections that I talked about when we were talking about Gallen actually reflect this. Not a single service has projected John Means next year with an ERA below 4.77. This is a guy with an ERA last year of 3.60. So again, the projections are kind of pointing out that Means could be a guy that is due for a little fade here. So let's look at some of the numbers. Strikeout numbers from last season, pedestrian to below average. 703 strikeouts per 9, below average. Swinging strike rate, extremely average at 9.9%. Like, just really average, pedestrian at that point. Batting average on balls in play, well below the league average of 300. Now, I've had conversations with people before. Batting average on balls in play, you don't want to use it a lot. Like, again, it's not going to be an end-all, be-all. But to me, when I factor all of this together, it is going to be something that's going to be part of the recipe here for me when I'm selling high on John Means. Batting average, again, on balls in play was 256 last year. It's 300 for league average. Keep in mind, too, those projections I talk about all project his batting average on balls in play at the league average of 300. And again, we have ERAs that are well over 477 across the board for a guy like John Means. And he doesn't get the ball down. You see that in the graphic right there. The ground ball to fly ball ratio is 0.68. 50% of his batted balls classified as fly balls. Keep in mind, too, we're talking about the AL East. He pitches at Camden Yards. It's not a recipe for success. So how do you fade a pitcher on the worst team in baseball? Potentially some of the favorites, not as big of a price against Baltimore, but that's the one hiccup here with John Means. Can you fade him on such a bad team? But those are your three sell-high pitchers for today. We'll have some buy lows as the year goes on. We'll keep this going as we get closer to baseball, and we'll keep track of them as well to see where we got things wrong and where we got things right. But when we come back, nothing but analytics. We dive into the Los Angeles Lakers, some bad matchups for them when they return to the postseason. Now's the time to become a VSiN Plus subscriber. It's free. You don't have to decide what you want to do, pay or cancel until at least one of the major sport returns. Check it out, VSiN.com/subscribe to sign up. It is The Edge here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. I'm Jonathan Von Tobel, and it is time for a segment we're going to steal from Matt Youmans. He named it, but we're taking it. Nothing but analytics here on The Edge. If you don't realize it, it stands for NBA. Nothing but analytics. Okay. Dude, I'm flying blind. This has been great. This is going to be the last day, though. To take people behind the scenes, my glasses broke. I can't see anything. That's why I have this giant piece of paper and a lot of notes. All right. So really quickly, before we get to our team of the day, the whole thing behind Nothing But Analytics, and it's not going to be just this. Like, once basketball season starts, we're going to expand on a lot of these matchups. But right now, as we wait for the return to play from the NBA and what's going to happen, we're going to go by a team-by-team basis. We're going to break down the strengths and weaknesses, both offensively and defensively, for all of these teams that we project to be playoff teams. And we'll include, because we did a little bit of this on a numbers game when we filled in a couple of weeks ago, we're going to include the teams that are bad matchups for the said team that we're analyzing that day and why they're bad matchups. So we're going to have the Lakers today, but we should note, and this just came up on my Twitter feed again, Thursday coming up, Board of Governors are going to vote and decide on a format in terms of return to play for the National Basketball Association. It seems pretty much locked in that it's going to be Orlando, and it looks like, as Woj just reported earlier today on, what's the Greenberg show? Get up. That the 22 team format, so again, that was a third option, 22 teams, 8 games play-in wise, that is going to be overwhelmingly supported. So it looks like we're going to get 22 teams back in Orlando. So we got 22 teams analyzed between now and the end of July. Regardless, today, the Los Angeles Lakers, our first team up. We'll start with the good teams and we'll get to the bad teams. There's still lots of stuff to talk about. Although by the time we get to a team like the Wizards, I think like every single team like of the 22, except for them themselves, are going to be bad matchups for them. So the Los Angeles Lakers. So their offensive strengths, like this is a team that is really pretty much well-balanced. There are some key weaknesses, and the weaknesses for Los Angeles all come on the offensive side of the floor. So we know about the strengths, right? Their efficiency overall, fourth best in the NBA, 112.6 points per 100 possessions. It's not surprising with a team that has LeBron James and Anthony Davis that they're the best team at the rim in terms of their shooting percentage, 68.9% within 4 feet. corner three-point shooting, and that's the cool thing about a lot of these numbers, right? One number begets the other. So they're really good at the rim, 68.9%. They're the seventh best team in terms of corner three-point shooting because you get a lot of driving kicks. You get a lot of traffic inside the rim. It opens up corners for a lot of the shooters. So they're the seventh best corner three-point shooting team. So let's talk about this, and we'll break these numbers down as they go. So it's not surprising that they can dominate inside, given the fact that they're built, you know, inside out with these two forwards. They hit at that high clip within 4 feet. The corner three-point shooting then comes. Success at the rim opens up the corners. What's worrisome, if you look at some of the weaknesses for this team, is that the three-point shooting beyond the corners is not that good. The three-point shooting overall, they're 20th in the NBA, 35.8%. Non-corner three-point shooting, so along the wing and, you know, top of the key, just 33.7% as an NBA team. That's 27th in the association. These numbers courtesy, of course, of cleaning the glass. So you just have two guys on this roster which can make or take, excuse me, more than three-point attempts per game and shoot above 37% from deep. So what worries you is the inside presence is great. LeBron and AD are phenomenal, as we know. But it has been the same issue with the Lakers as we move forward. And as we look at this team as a whole, it's that the playmakers outside of LeBron and Anthony Davis have been kind of the weak point here, right? Like Danny Green, for example. He's not a guy that's going to create his own shot. He's going to be a guy that's purely catch and shoot. And outside of that, you don't have a lot of guys that are really dudes who can make plays. Rajon Rondo, for example, I was looking at NBA.com earlier today. Rajon Rondo, when he's the ball handler in a pick and roll, he's actually the top guy in terms of frequency for the Los Angeles Lakers. Ball handler in pick and roll situations, they're averaging under 0.8 points per possession when Rajon Rondo runs a pick and roll as a ball handler. So it's really not good in terms of playmakers outside of your two stars. So beyond AD and LeBron, no guys to create their own shots, especially the perimeter, reflected in a lot. You see one of the strengths, too, by the way, for Los Angeles Lakers, transition. Massive strength for this team. LeBron James is, as we know, one of the best passers in the NBA, best passers in NBA history. He's great at starting the break. We know about the full-length court passes, how much and how quickly he can get up the floor with his team and get them a good look at the rim. But the offense bogs down in the half court, and it's reflected in both of the numbers that you see. Look at this. Think about it. Think about half-court possession for the Los Angeles Lakers at this point. LeBron or AD is going to get the ball in a half-court possession. AD ranks 12th in the league in terms of frequency of post-ups. So how many often or how often he posts up with the ball. It's 22.5%. But the Lakers average just 0.92 points per possession whenever he does it. For example, if you want like a little barometer, a Kevin Love post-up is actually worth more, 0.94 points per possession, than an Anthony Davis post-up at this point. Now, a lot of that has to do with playmakers around him, what Kevin Love has to do, and it's not a massive difference, but it just gives you a little bit of an idea of where Anthony Davis stands at this point. And the other half-court go-to is LeBron just playing in isolation. It's a 17.4% frequency whenever he does that. That's sixth in the NBA among qualified players, and the average is 0.92 points per possession. And it's not a slight to Anthony Davis, and it's not a slight to LeBron. It's just what happens outside of them when they get into these plays in the half-court that has been a massive issue for them. So the half-court presence is not really good. The Lakers really, really want to get out transition. They want to attack the rim. They want to get open three looks from the corners, and all their numbers dictate that. But then you go to their bench, and this is the other part with the Lakers. And keep in mind, too, by the way, as we're talking about this, the weaknesses are going to get really short when we get to the defensive side of the ball for the Lakers. But the offense, when you go to the bench, AD and LeBron, both off of the floor. Offensive rating, 108.7, 34th percentile among qualified lineups in the NBA. In the half court, it's even worse, where they're averaged just 86.4 points per 100 possessions, both AD and LeBron off the bench. When AD is on and LeBron is off, they're getting outscored by nearly a point every 100 possessions. That's a number we've talked about a lot here on the edge and throughout the season, as we talked about the big difference being the depth of the Lakers and a lot of these teams. And the half-court efficiency is a little bit better, but it's still among the 34th percentile in qualified lineups. So again, offense is really the biggest weakness for the Lakers. If they're not getting out in transition, if they're not attacking the rim, if it's not opening up the corners for shooters, they do have a little bit of a hard time. And of course, it's going to be against more skilled teams that can handle presence like LeBron and Anthony Davis. So then we get to the defensive side of the ball, and the list is really short when you look at the weaknesses. The fast break efficiency, which is a little weird because their defensive weakness is fast break efficiency. It's actually even not that bad. It's 15th in the NBA. They give 122.7 points per 100 possessions, but defense is where they thrive. Like, you can look at all the numbers, right? Even the ones that we have up there, all rank within the top five of the league. The worst category that we're showing you right now is what they give up at the rim, and they're still, what, sixth in the NBA, just giving up 60.8% within 4 feet. They like to get up and down. Means more opportunities for other teams to get up and down. So I'm a little curious as to why they rank so low. For a team that likes to run, why do they then give up that much efficiency going back the other way? But other than that, I mean, if you think about it from a personnel standpoint, it kind of makes sense, right? LeBron, AD, and then either JaVale McGee or Dwight Howard, right, as their center. Not exactly a lineup that'll get you up and down the floor defensively, and especially if you get up and down battle, I should say, in a quick pace battle between another team. So it might be a little bit slower in transition if they're rolling big like that. But other than that, defensively, they've been an absolute stalwart. So then we get to, okay, we looked at this from a statistical standpoint, offensively and defensively, their strengths and their weaknesses. So what are teams that would be bad matchups for the Los Angeles Lakers? It's a short list, and it's two really good teams. The first of which is the Milwaukee Bucks. And mainly because the Milwaukee Bucks, what they do defensively, if you haven't watched what Milwaukee does, a lot of their defensive game plan is we're going to cut off the rim. You're not going to get anything within 4 feet. They give up just 54.7% within 4 feet of the basket this year. They're going to give you three-point shots. They're really just going to let you go along the perimeter and take three-point shots. It's why they rank at this point 19th in terms of overall opponent shooting percentage from deep, and 36.3 is what they give up in non-corner three-point attempts to Milwaukee Bucks. Here's the kicker, though. We talked about it offensively, right? The Lakers' offense is successful when they get to the rim and they kick it out to the corners. Those are the two best offensive categories that we talked about. The Milwaukee Bucks are the best team in terms of the NBA at the rim. They're the 10th best team defensively in guarding the corners. When you can cut off the rim, the corners aren't as free, thus you can defend them pretty well. So we have two statistical categories for the Milwaukee Bucks in which they thrive that the Lakers want to take advantage of when they're playing basketball. So that's why this really isn't a good matchup for them. And then you look at it from another perspective. Milwaukee's the second-best half-court defense in the NBA. They're just giving up 99.6 points per 100 possessions in the half-court. So now you have a team in the Los Angeles Lakers that struggles within the half court, and you got a team in the Milwaukee Bucks who really thrives guarding in the half court. Again, not a good matchup for them. And then you get to, by the way, really quickly should note, right, with the transition thing, because they like to get up and down, Milwaukee wants to make it a half court game. December, Milwaukee won their matchup 111-104. That game had 97 possessions. March, the Lakers won that game 113-103. The game had 110 possessions. So again, speaking to the point of the slower game, Milwaukee won, the quicker game, the Lakers won. They want to get up and down the floor. And the last bad matchup is the Los Angeles Clippers. And this is more from a depth standpoint because the Clippers statistically have been really inconsistent. Like the numbers across the board aren't fantastic for the Los Angeles Clippers, but it comes to the point of, we talked about, AD and LeBron aren't on the floor, right? Obviously, they're getting outscored. With the Clippers, when they don't have Paul George and Kawhi on the floor, they actually have a positive net rating. This is a team that has a deep bench that can take advantage of that. And we haven't seen much of it. We've only seen 12 games. They added Marcus Morris. They have that big three. And what they're going to do with their new death lineup with Morris at center, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, and any mix of Landry Shamet, Patrick Beverley, and any of that trio remains to be seen. But from a depth perspective, the Los Angeles Clippers have a massive advantage over the Los Angeles Lakers. Why they were flirting with guys, you know, trying to get like a Darren Collison to come back and bringing them to games because they need to add a little bit depth, especially when it comes to ball handling for the Los Angeles Lakers. But the teams are where we stand right now. And look, the Lakers are good. Like, if you're hearing this and you're thinking that the Lakers are very good. The two bad matchups for them are the two best teams in the NBA up to this point. But really, when you look at this, when you're looking at good teams, you have to split hairs. And splitting hairs for the Los Angeles Lakers and realizing that from an offensive standpoint, outside of Anthony Davis and LeBron James, they're extremely limited. They're not a good three-point shooting team, and they don't have a lot of depth. And in series against the Los Angeles Clippers, which, by the way, they're down 2-1 in that season series in the regular season, and, of course, the Milwaukee Bucks, they need to get up and down. But the Milwaukee Bucks have more than enough personnel to make it a half-court game. So that's the breakdown for the Lakers. We'll have more on this. By the way, we'll talk more about futures odds, too, when it comes to nothing but analytics, because there is some value in a team like the Los Angeles Clippers. I rate as the best team in the NBA, but is it worth investing at, you know, under 3-1, somewhere in that range, to an NBA title, especially when we're playing on a neutral court, because that's the other part of this. How much of a factor is that, and what the format will be when we return to action? All right. First episode of The Edge in the books. Make sure you check out VSiN.com/bestbets if you missed out on any part of the program. Remember, we are back here Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific time on VSiN, the sports betting network. And if you want to watch, VSiN.com/subscribe. Plus subs are free until a major sport returns. We'll see you.